Lesson 5. Questions and Answers. Being Present Amidst the World.
I've never had so many questions at a retreat. And I'm not here to flatter you. The best question, of course, is no question. But I have never had as many good questions, so it's difficult. They all are, most of them are good questions, direct, live questions. I've never thrown away any questions yet. I keep even the silliest question. Might come in useful at some point. I will dip my hand in the basket in a second. One question that came 3 or 4 times. There are a few recurring questions. Can we sit with you in silence for a while? Yes. When you're just listening, there's stillness inside you. No commentary. So don't miss the stillness that's actually there even when the words are spoken here, both in you and in the speaker. There's no thinking in between sentences or words. So whenever a word has been uttered, the stillness is there again. Who is speaking? Not this person or this little mind. Stillness is speaking. It's not personal, not my stillness or your stillness. And I said before, this person is listening the same as you to the words. This person doesn't know what word is going to be spoken next as little as you know what word is going to be spoken next. It's not prepared. To trust in life enough for this to happen. To trust in life means to trust in this moment, the power of this moment. That whatever this moment requires, will be there. There were also two or three questions by people to whom the stillness is yet only a mental concept. And so they ask, it's great to hear about it, but I've never experienced the stopping of my mind. My mind is continuously noisy, compulsive. It continuously worries and thinks. So what can you tell me, they ask. There are also a few questions on meditation, the use, the purpose, usefulness, or otherwise of meditation. And I'd like to bring the two together, the two questions. Especially if the mind is incessantly active, even here, as you sit here. If you cannot notice the gaps, if you cannot be attentive to the gaps, now make sure that this is actually the truth, because you may actually notice the gaps for a moment. There may be a momentary cessation. But because you're so used to listening to your mind, to the mind is saying, no, nothing is going on. I don't get it. Maybe you do, briefly. However it may be, if your mind is has such overpowering momentum, meditation is a wonderful thing. There is a meditation, there are different methods. One could say, of course, that being in the body is a kind of meditation. Feeling the inner body, directing attention into the inner body is a kind of meditation. The way it's presented here is in a non-formal, formalized way. I just feel that. And it may be that people whose mind is extremely, extremely active may need a somewhat more formal approach to being in the body. And so there's a beautiful meditation technique, Vipassana, that directs your attention slowly and gradually into the body. So that would be a good thing to take up the practice of that. There are also mantras. If used rightly, they should stop the mind and replace all the various mental activities with just that, the mantra. And eventually, of course, the mantra needs to come to an end, and then the stillness is there. Buddhism has designed for hopeless cases. the counting meditation. Not hopeless, no. Where you count mentally from 1 to 10 and 10 to 1, or I think maybe you start at 100, I don't remember. But you count backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. And then that gives your mind something to do. But at least it becomes more focused. And once the chaos of the mind has become a more focused kind of noise, it's easier eventually to drop it once the chaotic noise has become focused noise. You can more easily drop once the noise has become focused than you could drop the chaos. It's hard to drop the chaos except in great suffering. The aim of all meditation, of course, is presence. Eventually, any technique needs to be let go of. If there's anybody here who feels angry at that statement, it's a good sign that it's time to let go. Because there's a new identification with form, my method that I'm so good at, that I've spent 20 years getting better at. So Vipassana is excellent. They claim, and it may well be true, whether they have some sutras to prove it, but who knows how old they are, but it may well be true that Vipassana is one of the original meditations taught by the Buddha. But it seems that the Buddha also taught another meditation, that is breath awareness. And that can be practiced not just as a meditation, that when you sit in a particular way, but to be aware of your breathing is a related already to being in the body, because the breath flows into the body. To notice your breath, to feel your in and out breath, is helpful. It does bring you into the now. When you do it for any length of time, you soon encounter the threshold of boredom, because observing your breath is not interesting. And then, if you stay with it, you will pass through the threshold of boredom, and then observing your breath is quite peaceful. The coming and going. And you notice great subtleties about your breath. You notice, for example, that at the end of each out-breath, there's a momentary cessation. In-breath hasn't started yet. You're neither breathing in nor out. And that's a point of great peace if you can notice that. a very peaceful, and also the end of the in-breath, there's a momentary cessation before the out-breath starts. You can watch that. Nature does it. They say the whole universe breathes in and out. If that is true, it may well be, because it's as with the, as below, as above, so below. They say the entire universe expands. Maybe it does. And then comes together again into one. And then it happens again. And the heart does that. And the seasons do that. This season is a kind of out-breath. Fall, autumn. Nature is breathing, has come to the end of the out-breath. And sometimes even when you get warm days in autumn, they are maybe the same temperature almost as summer, it has a different energy quality to it. It is stiller. It's moving towards cessation. Nature has come to the end of the out-breath. Fall is the out-breath, and the end of the out-breath is the equivalent of death. And that's why the autumn days can be so peaceful. Sometimes you can even sense the stillness in the air. Nature becomes, is ready to rest. So everywhere, you have this, the in and out breath. Each time you breathe out, it's a little death. And so you go into that death. And realize when you reach the point of death, the end of the out breath, you haven't disappeared. It's the deepest peace there. So that, now to come to another question, these are just happen to be a few that I remember. A few questions on how to bring awareness into the everyday world. Some people say, when I'm out in nature, it's wonderful. There's stillness. When I'm sitting here in the group, it's wonderful. Stillness arises. But the moment I go back into the city and my usual activities, it's gone. How to bring it into that? And of course, when you're in nature, your mind is not being stimulated because you're not surrounded by mind-made things. When you're in the city, everything around you is made by the human mind, and there is a collective energy field that is nervous mental activity. That's why cities are so noisy. The inner noise becomes externalized and then manifests as machines and amplifiers, boom, 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 producing so-called music. Very hard to find a restaurant these days where you are not bombarded with noise. And when you say, would you mind turning it down a little? I say, what's wrong with you? And then there's your workplace, probably dominated by nervous mental energy, like most workplaces are. Even places that could potentially be places of great peace and healing, they're very nervous. Hospitals are very nervous. Schools are very nervous. They're getting more and more nervous. School teacher, the most stressful, one of the most stressful of all jobs. Only 50 years ago, it was one of the most comfortable jobs. It was great. So bring in A little returns to presence into the noise as you go about your activities. How to do that? Just little things. You can even make a list of 3, 4, 5 things that you can do each day, periodically, simply to bring some return to presence. You may put next to your computer a little card that says, "Can you feel your feet? Can you feel your hands?" Or you may put in the bathroom, if they let you, in the office, "Take 2 or 3 conscious breaths." When the phone rings, don't jump to it. Let it ring twice and then answer it. And during that time, don't be in an inner state of, "Okay, I'm just holding back before I answer it." But no, give it, allow it to ring. It wants to ring, that's what it's doing. So you actually watch or listen to the ringing. You allow it. It goes, whatever sound it makes these days. And there you are. You look at the phone and you hear the sound. You've created a spaciousness inside. And that which drove you deeper and deeper into mind and into noise is reversed. Every time it rings, it becomes an instrument for some space, just a little bit of space, to arise inside you. Oh. And nobody would even notice that it took 2 more rings before you answered it. If there are steps, you can walk up and down the steps consciously, instead of making each step a means to an end. In other words, you're already where you want to be mentally. You're being pulled by the next moment to the next thing. You take the opportunity to take one step at a time. You don't even have to slow down after a while. You can actually walk fast without being pulled to where you need to get, without being pulled away from this moment. That's extremely enjoyable. It doesn't mean now, as presence, you bring presence into everyday life, that you necessarily have to slow down. At first, it may slow you down a little because it's an unusual way of doing things. But after a while, you realize that there's no need to slow down. If you actually, something needs to be done fast, you suddenly see your hands are moving fast. You're putting this here, packing your suitcase to get to the airport, you're running late, and yet suddenly there's only each movement and looking what it is that needs to be put in without even noise, because there's only the looking now. There's an opening of a drawer, you see. This is right action that comes out of presence. You don't think, "Okay, what do I need?" You can actually look and it happens. And then you walk fast and you enjoy the energy of that. And then you shut it and then you run down the stairs still without being pulled. Because if you're pulled away from the now into the future, that is the mental projection. So the mind projects itself there and says, "I need to be there." And then you're being pulled out of yourself. And it's called stress. And so you know when. But they also speak of stress in metal, which stress means there's one pull this way and one pull that way, and eventually it breaks if there's too much stress in metal. So humans live in continuous stress in this mad world, and stress is a form of fear. "I need to be there." So you bring in, first, into little things, presence. There's the phone. You could have a flower next to your computer screen. There's a flower. Always make sure there's a flower there. And something natural, because everything else, if you're in an office, is mind-made. There's a flower there, and periodically you look at it. Truly look. Just half a minute, a minute. The mind will tell you that you cannot spare 30 seconds to look at the flower. You just don't have the time. This cannot be true. Everybody has 30 seconds occasionally. If you can enter the body easily, feel that in your place of work, a great opportunity if you can do that. It's the most wonderful transformation. Whenever somebody speaks to you on the phone or in person, while you listen to that person, feel the aliveness in the inner body. And now, what is speaking to you is the human mind. It will try to get you entangled in what it's saying. But here now you are rooted here. You listen from there. And can you function in that way? Yes. Can you still reply intelligently? Or are you just going to make unintelligible sounds? No, you may be surprised that intelligible words come out of your mouth if you need to reply. They may be more intelligent than you would have said otherwise. Anytime there's a meeting, dreadful things, meetings, committee meetings, conference tables, everybody has their agenda. Everybody has their power positions. Everybody's fighting everybody else, or two temporarily get together to find those other, fight those other two, and all that madness. Around the table, if there's only one human being who is in the body, is often enough to change the entire energy field of the meeting. Even if it isn't, even if it doesn't do that, it gives you a degree of peace while you sit there. You will probably speak less, but when you speak, it is more likely that people will listen, because at last somebody is saying something new and meaningful. It does not come from ego. So in that sense, this healing is taking place through you, through not the personal you, but through this form, healing is happening. So you're not doing it just for yourself, because if one person becomes transformed in that way and brings in a different vibration, vibrational energy field, then things will change around them. If they are capable of change. Some structures are so heavy, old mind-made human structures, certain organizations. Some may be too heavy, they will just have to crumble eventually, and they will, sooner or later, probably sooner. Many other structures are still capable of change because there are humans in there. They're basically all mind structures. If you need to escape from the office, go to the bathroom, shut yourself in there, and sit there for 2 minutes. Not complaining about the mad world, but perhaps being aware of your breathing. And this is another little one that you can introduce anywhere, being aware, watching the breath as you go up and down the elevator. Wonderful. Who says that you cannot watch your breath when you're in the elevator? If that is at your workplace. And you will yourself will come up with little things on how to introduce spaces into that which seems to make it impossible to have space, those surroundings. And yet it's not impossible. I will dip my hand in the basket now. Take a few. There was a big one here. Maybe it works. Another big one got blown away by the wind. Sometimes it doesn't. When I let go of my story, I feel less alive. What is the value of going to a place where I feel less alive? It is true. Better than to be dead is to have a dramatic story. Better than not feel any aliveness is to have some drama, something interesting going on in your life. And so you see, often in relationships, the partners feel if they are not going through their periodic drama, they don't have a relationship anymore. It feels the aliveness is going out of it. But the story is a secondary kind of aliveness. The drama that people get involved in, yes, it's a way of feeling some life in the absence of feeling something much deeper and more genuine. But you have to step out of the story temporarily to find that. And a good starting place is going into the body, not just for a minute, but make it into a daily practice for a while, and go deeply within and sense the enormous amount of vibrant life that is already there in the body. Bring attention to your sense perceptions and notice the enormous power of your conscious attention. So it's a question of leaving your habitual world where you felt at home and entering something new. And at first the new you may not recognize. It happens also when people first encounter some stillness and it's such a strange place that they feel they want to run back to the mental noise, and they say, well, I encountered some stillness but it felt completely empty and so I don't see why I should go there. I compare these people to someone who just spent 4 hours in a noisy discotheque and then steps out and the heavy doors close behind, and you're out in the countryside with only very subtle noises of the night going on and a breeze. But at first you step out, you hear nothing. It will feel dreadful, that silence, because you're so used to that noise. So you might even, in fear, run back into the discotheque. But at least that's familiar. You have to stay for a while with the stillness, because the power of that is more subtle. It's more powerful, but also much more, it has a different density to it than the density of the mind, a different frequency. So you become attuned to that frequency. So you stay in the emptiness for a while and then realize the emptiness is also fullness. Now, the desire to step out of your story only comes really when the story becomes too unpleasant to want to dwell in it. So it may be that some people have to wait a little bit longer until their story turns into something that they don't want to be in anymore. And eventually that will happen. There is greater aliveness, true aliveness, outside of the story. What determines the intensity of a person's wish to be in the present moment? What one could perceive as the wish to be in the present moment is the arising of presence in you. In that sense, there's nothing you can do about it. When the wish appears, presence is already arising. It's not separate from it. But can you make it arise? No. So what determines whether or not presence is arising in you? We could say grace, evolution, how much you've suffered. Maybe they're all the same. But in any case, it is not something that you can want to happen. And you wouldn't. You wouldn't even want to be present if presence were not arising. You wouldn't even ask the question how to be more present. So it is arising. The wish to be present is the arising of presence. It's ultimately not personal. And yet, from a personal perspective, where language comes from and where we have to speak from a lot of the time, we can say that you can help the arising of presence, being receptive to it. But it's all really something that the universe is doing through you. When you think you are doing it, and it's great to believe that I can choose to be present. I can choose not to answer this phone and let it ring twice. That's what it looks like. But how is it possible for you to even do that? If there were not enough presence, you couldn't do it, nor would you want to do it. You would say, what is the point in waiting? I mean, it's ringing, answer it. And maybe that's what your boss will say when he sees what you're not answering. Ultimately, it's not you. Because you are not separate from the totality of the universe. It just seems that way. But it's good to feel that you can choose. Ultimately, the universe is choosing to be present through you. Nobody else can choose. Well, there's an interesting question. Maybe it's connected with this. You've given us many portals to the stillness within, but I find that in day-to-day life, my mind is in 100% control and does not want to be free of itself. How do we become aware when we don't want to? When you don't want to, you don't want to. But there is something hidden in the question, which to me signifies that something in you does want to. Otherwise you would neither be sitting here nor be asking that question. You'll be watching TV somewhere. I get discouraged when I think, well, Eckhart didn't awaken through the practice of presence. He awakened through a sudden act of grace that completely erased his mind's habit of resisting the present moment, and so did many other teachers I know of. Presence was the result of your awakening, but it wasn't the method. Are you sure? Ordinary people... Are you sure ordinary people can dissolve their ego through the practice of presence when that's not how you did it? I worry that I'm trying to break down the boulder of my ego with a pocket knife when what I really need is a stick of dynamite. Sometimes it happens with a pocket knife, but this isn't a pocket knife. This here is a sword. Now, it may well be that even the sword is not enough, and it may be that you need a stick of dynamite in the form of some disaster. And if you need it, you'll get it. If you truly need it, life will provide. Life provides what you need, and then you will see the grace that is hidden there when it comes. And another part of the question implied, is it something we can do, or is it something that just happens to us? The doing and the happening are really one. When you think you're doing, it's also happening to you. But it's good to feel that you're doing it. That's meant to be part of the happening. The mind can't figure that out. Because the mind says it's either this or that. The mind likes to separate. That's how the mind works. It cuts it into two. It's this or that, how can it be both? But it is. Something else that this touches on? A sudden liberation from being possessed by the mind, or a gradual becoming free through perhaps some applied spiritual practice. What is true that ultimately spiritual practice or technique, let us say as such, I don't know of anybody who has become liberated by a technique. But they may have become liberated when they dropped the technique. The technique may have had its place as a ladder that they then dropped, or as a raft. Buddha uses the analogy of a raft crossing the river. You use it to cross the river. When you've reached the other side, you do not continue to carry it around with you, the raft. It remains. My raft. Not all teachers, not to all of them did it come all at once. Many, yes. For example, many of you know the teachings of Nisargadatta, who wrote one of the greatest spiritual books. Well, he didn't write it, he spoke it. I am that. And he had a stall in Bombay selling handmade cigarettes. One would have thought, this is not very good karma, you're making other people ill. And he smoked quite heavily, apparently. And he just visited a guru, a teacher, who said, well, just remember that you are consciousness. Just be aware of the I am. In whatever you do, feel yourself as consciousness. Oh, okay. And then he went off back to his daily business and he applied. Can we call that a technique? It's too simple to be called a technique. All he remembered is, I'm consciousness. And he's attempted to feel the deeper I that underlies all experiences, awareness itself. And a few years later, it had emerged fully. It didn't come all at once, but it didn't take very long. And then suddenly he started speaking wisdom. A cigarette seller, almost illiterate, suddenly people would come and ask him questions, and intensely alive and wise answers came out of his mouth. Something had come through the form, and so the cigarette seller became Nisargadatta Maharaj. In India, they like giving people names. Maharaj means the great king, spiritually, of course. So this is a teacher to whom it came not suddenly, although it didn't take very long, but after a few years, it became a continuous living presence. Presence was continuous in him. Now, as it is becoming a more widespread phenomenon, and this is happening, many people experience at first as a lessening of suffering, a considerable lessening of suffering in their lives. They can breathe. There's some space. There may still be drama occasionally, but there's space also. To many people, it is coming gradually. And to others, it is coming in an accelerated form. In this culture, these days, it often happens through an illness, AIDS, cancer. And I know quite a few to whom it came in that way, and I could see, and I told them, you are on an accelerated course. What otherwise probably would have taken much, much longer is happening now through your illness that is forcing you into presence. And others don't need an illness. It's happening. I cannot tell you whether you're better off with an illness or without it. If you choose presence, and this is only a limited perspective, it's not the ultimate truth, then it's less likely that you'll need to be hit over the head in order to crack the remaining shell. If you die to the past every moment and return to just the freshness of this, don't carry personal past, the past in relationships, the past that you have with people. Yesterday they said that or whatever. Meet a person as if for the first time. Look at them and be there as a presence, not as a heavy personal past. Be the attention. Be the attention that is looking at them. Because that's what you are. Be the consciousness that flows through your eyes as you look at them and listen to them. You are that. And then you... The beautiful expression in the Course in Miracles that is used for the present moment is the holy instant. To realize the only place that is sacred in life is this moment. If you only pay attention to it, you notice the sacredness of whatever form it takes, even if it looks horrible at first, because what looks horrible at first will be some kind of death, some kind of breaking down, and there also is sacredness. We already pointed to that, particularly there.
No.
Something had come through the form, and so the cigarette seller became Nisargadatta Maharaj. In India, they like giving people names. Maharaj means the great king, spiritually, of course. So this is a teacher to whom it came not suddenly, although it didn't take very long, but after a few years it became a continuous living presence. Presence was continuous in him. Now, as it is becoming a more widespread phenomenon, and this is happening, many people experience at first as a lessening of suffering, a considerable lessening of suffering in their lives. They can breathe. There's some space. There may still be drama occasionally, but there's space also. To many people, it is coming gradually. And to others, it is coming in an accelerated form. In this culture, these days, it often happens through an illness, AIDS, cancer. And I know quite a few to whom it came in that way. And I could see, and I told them, you are on an accelerated course. what otherwise probably would have taken much, much longer is happening now through your illness that is forcing you into presence. And others don't need an illness. It's happening. I cannot tell you whether you're better off with an illness or without it. If you choose presence, and this is only a limited perspective, it's not the ultimate truth, then it's less likely that you'll need to be hit over the head in order to crack the remaining shell. If you die to the past every moment and return to just the freshness of this, don't carry personal past, the past in relationships, the past that you have with people. Yesterday they said that or whatever. Meet a person as if for the first time. Look at them and be there as a presence, not as a heavy personal past. Be the attention. Be the attention that is looking at them. Because that's what you are. Be the consciousness that flows through your eyes as you look at them and listen to them. You are that. And then you, the beautiful expression in the Course in Miracles that is used for the present moment is the holy instant. To realize the only place that is sacred in life is this moment. If you only pay attention to it, you notice the sacredness of whatever form it takes. Even if it looks horrible at first, because what looks horrible at first will be some kind of death, some kind of breaking down, and there also is sacredness. We already pointed to that, particularly there.
No.
How can I get over or release the outrage I, among others, feel about the political situation in the United States? Bush and his policies, which led to the invasion of Iraq, the dismantlement of the U.S. social services and civil liberties. Should I really let go, release this outrage? Outrage, I assume, is a kind of anger. There are many places where you can look in this world. Countries, places, institutions, governments. And you see varying degrees of human unconsciousness at work. Wherever you look, you see the manifestation of human unconsciousness. Unconsciousness, of course, I'm not saying they are totally they are identified with the mind and the old patterns of the mind, the collective ego. And wherever you look still, you see it, because the change that is happening in humanity to a large extent is on the inner. It only slowly reaches the outer levels where you can actually detect it. It takes a while before it reaches an institution, before it reaches a politician, before it reaches somebody in a position of power, but occasionally it already happens. Russia had a relatively enlightened human being after having had succession of leaders who seemed, you didn't even know whether they were alive or dead when you saw them when they were having their there was actually speculation. There was. Is whoever, Brezhnev or whoever the names were, is he still alive or did they just put a puppet there that went? And some others speculated that there was it was an actor acting because they didn't dare say that he had died, so they gave an actor the role to play. And this maybe have been true, we don't know. And that's one form of unconsciousness, and the entire the structure of that regime was started from an ideal. The mind saw something beautiful. We must have equality. No personal possessions. But nothing had changed in the human mind. The structures were still in place, so we got that instead. And then suddenly there was Gorbachev, who compared to the previous leaders was a Buddha in consciousness. I remember once a remark he made on television when he was still president. They asked, there was a little scandal about some Western spies and Eastern spies had been thrown out of the country. Some, the usual thing. And what about this scandal about the Russian spies in the Russian embassy? And he said, well, as the wise man said, this too will pass. And it did. However, it is rare for this shift that is happening in human consciousness to reach the outer forms, the institutions, the political, the government, the institutions, whatever it may be, the outer forms, businesses, the way businesses are run, companies. In most cases, they're dominated still by the old egoic consciousness. And I've spoken to some people who work in corporations, who say there's so much infighting and useless power struggles going on within the corporation, it's a miracle that anything gets done at all. And everybody lives in fear and they're not happy. So wherever you look in the world, you'll find still on the surface of things varying degrees of unconsciousness. And only occasionally something else comes through already here and there. It does. Even on television, sometimes you see it. You see there's a conscious being speaking or a film that has a message pointing to conscious awareness or pointing to stillness. It happens. Maybe it happens more now. It's happening more. It's always wonderful. I love it when I see a film that points to the truth. And there are quite a few now. Not the majority yet, of course. But there are so many things that you could feel angry about if you personalize human unconsciousness. If you make it into an identity, then you say, these dreadful bastards, look what they are doing. It's human unconsciousness. Jesus saw it clearly when he said, they know not what they do. In other words, they are unconscious. And so a country sometimes, also can vary. A country can be pulled into unconsciousness to some extent by an unconscious leader. Germany is a best example of what happened there. A country that, compared to others on the planet, was one of the most highly developed, cultured, scientifically, literature, culture, philosophy, music, and all that to no avail. They dropped right down into unconsciousness. Back. But this wouldn't have happened if there had not been a strong, enormous amount of collective pain body still in the country, and an enormous amount of collective ego, despite the so-called cultural achievements. So when you see it as unconsciousness, you're less likely to feel angry about it, because anger does not really fulfill a very useful purpose. It doesn't really change things. It contributes more. You're being pulled into unconsciousness through anger. You become unconscious yourself. See it for what it is. And then the next step is, what can you do? You have to accept that this is so, which does not mean there's nothing you can do. Once you have accepted that there's still a considerable amount of unconsciousness here on the planet, wherever you see it, wherever you feel it's mostly, you feel called upon to do something in this or that area. It could be the destruction of nature. It could be the polluting of oceans and rivers. It could be on the political scene, American politics, other politics, Middle East, great focal point of unconsciousness. It's just look at the situation there. The there's no stop, no pause to the fighting between the two. And they're both victims of the other. And they're both totally convinced that they're victims of the other. So when you see it, then you can point out certain things. Write, speak to people, have a website that says the truth about such and such, so and so, and just state the facts that as they are. This is how it is. If you want to, you can stand at a street corner and hold up something, a sign. A few people may start talking to you. They are more likely to listen if you are not angry, but simply explain, look, this is how it is. They are more likely to watch your website if it doesn't have this, the screaming anger about it. You're not convincing anybody who has the opposite view to yours, who says Bush is the greatest leader that has happened to America in a long time. You're not going to convince them with your anger that you are right. Anger will, their own position will become more entrenched. And so if you're right, then state the facts. This is how it is. Explain. If you can see the futility of anger, it's more likely to drop away. And there's something more powerful then. You can speak with passion, without anger, but passion, about what you feel is true. Be aware, very careful with identifying with mental positions, though, when you do that. Identifying with a position as me or us against. Be very careful with making wrong others, groups of people, or individuals, because it draws you back into unconsciousness. Don't personalize it in that way. When doing projects of any sort, large or small, I find I must keep my intent fiercely in mind or I end up doing something else. By employing this fierce focus, am I actually being counterproductive in the long run or in the big picture? The focus, when you have a project that needs to be done, finished. Now, the questioner is saying, keeping my intent fiercely in mind. Now, the intent, I assume, is where you want to get to, the finished project, where you want to, the point that you want to arrive at to get it done. So my intent is getting to that point where the project is finished. My intent is drawing up a plan, a business plan, or the architect does a building, draws up a huge high-rise office building, or whatever, or there may be a project of any kind that you need to finish. There's the intent, and that's very much, I compare it to a journey. When you're traveling from here to there, maybe you're walking, let's say the rudimentary form, the early form of journeying, of being on a pilgrimage or journeying. Tourists didn't exist at that time. It was unknown. The people would journey because they had to leave their country or they went on some kind of army expedition or pilgrimage, spiritual journey. That was perhaps the most common journey that individuals would undertake, pilgrimage. You know where you need to go. The question is, what is it that takes up most of your attention, the place that you need to get to or the step you're taking at this moment? What's more important? Now, in many cases these days, what people are obsessed with is the outcome where they need to get to. And that causes the stress. I need to get this done, finished, over with. And I'm on a limited time scale here. Can't waste any minute. It needs to get done. I need to. So there's an excessive projection to the finished end product, the point in the future that I need to get to. And then the doing itself, it is done in a hurried way. A rest, there's the energy. Okay, come on, what's the next? It doesn't matter what you're doing. Let's say you have to complete something that you manufacture with your hands. But this thing has to be ready by tomorrow. The world is mad these days. It always tells you this. You have no time. You have to do it by tomorrow. And so you become excessively focused on tomorrow. I have to get this, the finished product. Or you're thinking that I can sell this. When it's finished, I can sell it. So it's done quickly with the end in mind. The end takes over your mind, occupies your mind more than the present moment, and you reduce the present moment to a means to an end. That's how a lot of doing happens these days. And all that doing is of low quality. Any doing that reduces this moment to a means to an end to a future moment is not high quality doing. And you can observe that when you observe how a person works, whether they are totally attentive, give total attention to whatever they are doing at this moment, which does not mean that they don't know where they are going to in their project. That is peripherally in their field of attention. The point they want to get to is peripherally in their field of attention. Like a traveler who is walking towards Rome, let's say, and they are taking this step and are fully conscious of each step they are taking, but peripherally they know where they are going. It's over there. It's a long way away, but they know it's over there. So the focal point of there is the quality of your step at this moment, because if you're not careful, you'll stumble, you'll never get to Rome. The quality of each step is what matters, and the getting is secondary. It is on the periphery. You have the goal in mind also, but no, it does not occupy your mind. It does not overpower you. And so then the present moment is not a means to an end. You give your full attention to this moment. I have seen a few, not many, and some of them are highly so-called effective and successful people who did not become successful through strain and stress. Some did, and they are very unhappy and won't be around for long. But I have observed a few who, whoever they meet, whoever they talk to, or whatever is presented to them, they are totally there with it. If you come to them and ask them a question, they may be high up, so to speak, in social terms, the CEO of this or that corporation, and somebody comes to them, and there are a few, not many, who will give you total attention, no matter who you are. And that is wonderful. Everybody loves doing what they tell them to do because they feel so valued, because attention is the greatest gift you can give. Full attention. You're acknowledging that human being beyond the roles that they play in the world. So they're giving everything their fullest attention, and they are extremely effective at what they do. Others look as if they were effective, but everything they do is contaminated with extremely stressful raw energy that is really a form of suffering. And they spread unhappiness. So it is possible to work effectively, in fact more effectively, by focusing on what it is at hand here right now to do, without losing in your peripheral vision the place you need to get to. That remains here, there. One step, Rome is there, but this step is here, and this step is more important. Whenever you see any work of quality that's been made by a human being, it means some attention must have gone into it, some human attention. Somewhere there must have been someone who did not reduce the moment in which that was being made to a means to an end, where it gave. So you have works of art that have that quality, handicraft, things made by artisans in the original way, not under stress of having to produce. Because attention is also loving care. Another aspect of attention is whatever you give attention to, there is a loving care that flows into the doing. So if you give attention to a human being that comes into the now, the field of now, and this is so beautiful, to give each human being that comes into your field of vision to you with this or that demand or question or whatever it may be, give them full and complete attention. That doesn't mean you get drawn into their story. You don't give attention necessarily to their mind stream and energize that. You simply give attention. There's a spaciousness. There is the awareness, the current of awareness flows into the looking. The same way you look at a tree, you hold. And that is beautiful. So see how things work in that new way. And observe, if you can find anybody who is present in doing something, observe them. It's wonderful to watch somebody at work in that way. And it won't really be perceived as work by them. It's joyful. Here is one question that has appeared about 10 times in different forms. How would you suggest imparting these teachings to children?
Lesson 5, continued on disc 7.